Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you that you speak. We thank you that you open heaven, and therefore we can see more clearly. Help us to experience the open heaven this evening. The fact that that door remains open and you still give us sight to see the world's events through your eyes. Help us to see tonight. In the name of your Son. Amen. I wonder if it ever crosses your mind that this world is not the way it's supposed to be. I wonder if it ever pops in your brain that what is going on around us in the everyday is quite possibly weird, maybe even unnatural, dare I say it, abnormal. When you look upon the world, does the thought form in your mind, this is bizarre? There is something quite bizarre about this world. Because I come to the conclusion things are not the way they're meant to be. If you want to get a handle on how bizarre the world is, all I encourage you to do is read the newspaper. Every day you'll have a stream of stories that will feed your ever-wanting lust for stories that testify of bizarreness. For example, a few weeks ago in the Herald, I received some new statistics, which I'm very excited about. I'm a statistics kind of person. And they made me question the nature of reality once again. I had to revisit some key philosophical assumptions. What happened was that the National Health Service in Britain released their stats on the injuries that people presented to emergency rooms with in Britain, the causes behind their injuries and why they turned up. Now, people who know me in my sermons from previous times will know that I've done this kind of line before, but with American statistics. Because I thought only Americans did bizarre things to get into the ER, but apparently the Brits are not far behind. It appears British people are getting injured in some peculiar ways. Now, the health data included some standard favourites, like how many were injured by falls. I think it was something in excess of 200,000 Britons. How many people had been stung by bees? How many people had been bitten by rats? Six, in case you're wondering. And then I stumbled onto this fact. In 2004, two British people were admitted to the ER after being injured by centipedes. Now, one centipede incident a year I can handle, but two constitutes a crime wave. You can just see the TV special, When Centipedes Attack, you know. The Hollywood movie, 100 Fists of Fury. The cockroaches said he was just an insect, but he showed them who's boss of this phylum. Going back to your biology class for those of you. There's more stuff going on here. One child presented to a British ER after experiencing a prolonged bout of weightlessness. Now, before you go off half-cocked and think that he went to the NASA space station and walked into the wrong cafeteria, it appears that his parents strapped him into a gravitron at a fairground and went off and had a coffee and didn't come back quick enough. Another interesting statistic is that last year, 37 Britons fell victim to a volcanic eruption. That's an interesting choice of words, fell victim. Like I was just behind the pub, governor, and then this volcanic eruption just came out of nowhere. I wasn't doing nothing. But weirdness in medical happenings is not limited to Britain. A few years ago, I found this newspaper piece on a Turkish man. Doctors in an eastern Turkish hospital have removed a screwdriver, 20 nails, 6 magnets and lengths of metal wire from the stomach of a 20-year-old man who was admitted to hospital with stomach pains. I wonder why. It was reported yesterday. Bob the Builder, can we eat it? Bob the Builder, yes we can. Evidently, when this guy saw that Bunnings was having a sale, he thought it meant you could buy a value meal. The world is a weird place. Strange events happen. People seem to act in very unnatural ways. And there's a chaotic element to our existence. But the evidence that the world is not the way it's supposed to be is far more serious than the stories of the bizarre. Even in the major stories, the feature stories, you can't help but pick up that things aren't the way they're supposed to be. Something's horribly wrong. At the level of individual lives, it seems that many people are so fed up with existence that they no longer want to continue. They're so confused and frustrated that many people are ending it all. The great philosopher Albert Camus once said, there is only one really serious philosophical question, and that is suicide. Deciding whether or not life is worth living is to answer the fundamental question in philosophy. Well, a few days ago I read an article on the phenomenon of suicide in Japan, and it's quite horrifying. Last year, 34,472 people killed themselves in Japan, which equates to 94 people a day. They woke up one morning and said, it was meant to be so much more, but it never will be, and I'm out of here. But it's not just at the level of individual lives that we see a world gone mad. At the national level, the structural and social levels, we see the reality of poverty, of hunger, of inequality and disease. I've shared these statistics with the folks at Club Red, but they bear repeating. If the hungry people of this world were lined up shoulder to shoulder, they would form a line around the globe that stretches 18.2 times around our globe. Roughly 1.2 billion people in this world are undernourished, and about 25% of the world's population, yes, 25% of the world's population has no access to safe drinking water. From among those people, 1.4 million children, that's right, 1.4 million children will die this year. And yet here's the deal, friends. The world produces a surplus of food. And we flush away pure water to remove our human waste. Things are not the way they are supposed to be. But even to summarize it like that is not enough, because there is one other fact that testifies to how screwed up the world is. And that is the reality of idolatry in the world. Whether it be the wooden carvings of the false gods of Hinduism all the way through to the slavery of the West to the god of money, a great proportion of the world refuses to listen to the voice of the true and living God. And so it worships created things instead of the Creator. The world is not the way it's supposed to be. Something has gone horribly wrong. Whether it be hopelessness and despair at the individual level, injustice at the national level, or just flat out idolatry everywhere, things are not the way they're meant to be. But here's the problem. People have grown comfortable with the way things are. People have grown accustomed that this world gone mad is natural and normal. People who used to be shattered by suicide statistics basically now shrug their shoulders and go, it's just the way it is. It's natural selection. People who used to watch the World Vision ads on TV and think, man, I really should do something about starving children, now say things like, it's economically irrational to give that much money to Africa. Aren't we wonderful beings that it's now rational to let people starve? And the people of this world have become such idolaters, whether it be slaves to the Western gods, the Eastern gods, or any other god you want to substitute, that now the only heresy left in Western society is to be a Christian. The only heresy left in Western society is to believe in Jesus. Have you ever noticed that if you stand up for Jesus now in Australian culture, what people are likely to call you? You're a freak. You're a Jesus freak. You're unnatural. You're an extremist. Have you heard about Mark? He's got religion, like it's a disease. That's the world we live in. We live amongst a people who have gone mad. We were a people who had gone mad. We live amongst a people who think this is normal. We live in a world that is most definitely not the way it's supposed to be. And in the same way, the first readers of the book of Revelation were living in that kind of a world. They were living in a world of individual, national, and idolatrous despair. At the individual level in the world of Rome, people experienced despair and hopelessness. One of the most common epitaphs on Roman gravestones reads like this, and I apologise to the Latin speakers, I'm not skilled in this science. Non fui fui, non sum, non cluo. I didn't exist, I existed, I don't exist, I don't care. In terms of poverty and inequality and the functionings of the economy, the ancient world had as much, if not more, inequality and oppression. And in terms of idolatry, the Roman world had gone mad, for it worshipped a whole host of gods, including human beings. Yes, emperors who had been deified. And what was so terrifying about this society was that this world was seen as natural and normal by citizens of the empire. They blessed Rome not because they thought she was unjust, but because they thought she had brought prosperity to the province. Oh, you've brought peace. We'll ignore the people you killed to do it. And the worship of the Roman emperor had become so normal that those people who didn't participate in it were seen as deviants. You're a rebel against the social order if you don't worship the emperor. Because when the world thinks madness is normal, then what is normal looks like madness. When the world thinks madness is normal, then what is normal looks like madness. When people come to believe that the present state of affairs, this world, is everything that it's meant to be, when people make their peace with the present reality, then any person who dares to come along and preach a gospel of salvation, a gospel that brings transformation, will be called a weirdo. You have to be. And that was the pain of the early Christians, that they were being called freaks of their society, that they were being put to the margins, that they were being set aside as people who were haters of the human race. If you read the Roman historians like Tacitus, Suetonius, Pliny, they all say it. They sit there and go, well, we probably shouldn't persecute Christians that much, but they are Christians, and that's really weird. That's what they were facing. That you're not normal to believe in Jesus. You need to be reminded, though, just as they needed to be reminded, that if you feel abnormal now, you need to get a fresh perspective on what is normal. You need to get a fresh perspective on what God thinks is important. Because in the middle of that situation, what you need reaffirmed is that behind all the surface appearances, to the contrary of what everybody else is telling you, another kind of life is possible. Another kind of existence is possible. And to worship the true and living God is right and proper and correct. You need to be reminded that although you feel like a freak, in light of heaven's perspective, you're spot on. To live life as a follower of Jesus means to fall into line with your Creator's purpose. And that is the best kind of normal. That's why chapters 4 and 5 are where they are in Revelation. Having introduced the context in Revelation 1 to 3, 4 and 5 aims to take God's people into heaven to see things from the true perspective, God's perspective. Jesus gives his people this vision to remind them, you've picked the right team. It's the most natural and normal thing you could ever do to follow Jesus. What John is showing in chapters 4 and 5 is a vision of heaven. Now, heaven can mean more than one thing in the Bible. It can sometimes just mean the sky, as in the heavens and the earth. But heaven, when it's referring to God, is referring to the place of God's dwelling. Wherever God is, heaven is. That is, wherever he chooses to set up his home is heaven. The interesting thing about heaven is not where it is, but who's there. Because it's always where God is. Now, in the present age, heaven is an invisible spiritual realm, a place that is separated, in some sense, from the earth. You can't see it and perceive it with normal eyes, but it exists, and it's the true reality that stands behind all the false realities that we encounter on earth. In fact, it is the exact opposite of earth. For on earth, we encounter rebellion and sin. We encounter evil and injustice, but in heaven, God's presence is fully made known, and God's rule is universally acknowledged. That's why John gets taken up to heaven, because he needs to know, and his churches need to know, what does God think about my situation? Have I got it right? At the surface level of things, it looked like Rome was winning. Caesar was on his throne. Christians were getting killed if they stood up for Jesus. And it looked like Rome had control of the earth. And so when John enters into heaven, he needs to see a new throne. The throne of the one who truly rules the universe. And he needs to see a new vision of normal. Because here is a realm where it's natural to worship God. Here is a realm where it's normal to bless his name. He sees a heaven which is saturated with God's presence. He sees a throne that sparkles with like special jewels or of the radiance of special jewels and has a radiance and a luminosity like a rainbow, an emerald rainbow. And in this world, which is populated by all sorts of beings, there's one reality that is so true, and that is God is at the center. Everything circles around God. Everything surrounds him, but he is the center. And so you see it populated by all sorts of special beings, like the 24 elders of verse 4. To be honest with you, nobody's quite certain who they are. Because we don't have any definite parallel from the Old Testament, Greco-Roman literature, or Jewish literature. We can't work out on the basis of our standard little guides to biblical symbolism exactly who they are. They're kind of a new phenomenon. Most people think divide into two camps, that they're angels, a special class of angels, or that they're somehow representative of God's people. But here's the point. It doesn't matter if they're angels or if they're representative of God's people, because if John wanted you to know that, he probably would have made it clearer. The issue is not their specific identity, but what they do. Because what they do, these special beings who appear to be clothed with glory and honour with their majestic clothing and their crowns, when they come into the presence of the Holy One, when they come into the presence of the One who is the centre of the universe, they cast their crowns to the ground and they worship Him. And that is what's important about the 24 elders. That no matter what crown you wear, no matter what crown any creature wears, no matter how honoured or gifted or brilliant you feel, in the presence of the Almighty, you have no claim. And you put your crown down because He is the only one who stands above all things. He is the only one who keeps His crown on no matter what. The story is told of the funeral of the French King Louis XIV. And the priests looked down at the body of Louis XIV, this great French monarch. And beneath all the robes of royalty, he saw that it was a cold, dead corpse. And as he turned to begin his funeral talk, he said these words, "My friends, only God is great. I don't care how good you are. In the presence of God, you put down your crown." But it's interesting to note that the 24 elders are not the lead worshippers in heaven. Nor does worship appear to be led by Darlene Jack. At least these guys don't look like Darlene. They don't look like anything I've ever encountered before. They look like four living creatures, one with the face of an ox, one with the face of a man, one with the face of a wild lion, one with the face of an eagle. Now these images seem to be drawn from some of the accounts of angels in the book of Isaiah and the book of Ezekiel. But irrespective of how they function in those books, in this book, Revelation, they seem designed to represent the entirety of God's creatures. There was a Jewish saying in the rabbis that said, "The mightiest of all wild animals is the lion, and the mightiest of the birds is the eagle, and the mightiest of the domesticated animals is the ox, and the mightiest of all creatures is the human being." And so here we have represented before the throne of God all of creation, which tells you this, that all of creation was made to ceaselessly praise its maker. Not just human beings, but all things were made to ceaselessly praise their maker. And so that is why the song of the 24 elders in response to the lead worshipping of the living creatures is to celebrate God's creative power in verse 11. In here we have the fulfillment of Psalm 150 when the psalmist cries, "Let everything that has breath praise the Lord." And the living creatures are representative of that. What is normal is to have a universe which sings the glory of God, not just a voice of human choirs.
Here is the first basis for praise of the living God, that he is the creator of all things. Here is where the pretentious claims of all other deities fall apart. I mean, you can pull out a $5 note and you can sit there and go, I love you. Thank you for making me. Thank you for crafting me in the womb. But it's not true. Money doesn't make you. Nor does money make the world go round. No other god, whether carved from wood or stone or made by the Reserve Bank, can rescue you, can create you, can do anything. It's like Habakkuk says in chapter 2 of his prophecy. Idols are fantastic. They can't do anything. You carve them and they can't speak. You try and pick them up and give them life, but they can't give you life. But here is the Creator who can give you life and bring all things into being. And what this means is that you were meant to live for so much more. You weren't meant to live a life of despair and hopelessness. The creation wasn't meant to live a life of despair and hopelessness. You were meant to live a life where the Creator was ceaselessly praised by his creation. And God's implementation of that vision began in the Garden of Eden, the goal of having heaven on earth, but it was fractured and broken by human sin. And so God's passion from the start is that the reality of heaven and the reality that what John sees in heaven would happen on earth. But of course we know it doesn't. We know there is a divide. The very fact that this vision takes place in heaven and not on earth reminds us that God's purposes for the world are not complete. The fact that it occurs in heaven stands in contrast to the false worship that is happening right now on earth. Because that, my friends, is at the essence of what the story narrated in Revelation is about. How does God get the earth to go from a world that is worshipping the beast to a world that is worshipping the one true king? The story of Revelation is ultimately the story of heaven coming to earth. And that's why the turning point in this section is the introduction of the scroll. Because the scroll is, amongst all other things that you might think it is a document that contains the secret purposes of God to bring his kingdom on earth. The scroll contains the contents of the story that will bring heaven on earth. But in order for that story to happen, one must come who is worthy to open the scroll. And at first the angel requests, is there anybody in creation who can do it? And he finds none. And John weeps. And this is the weeping of the sinner. It is the weeping of the creation that cannot save itself. Nothing in creation can get itself out of its own pit. But then comes Jesus. And he is not described as Jesus, but in a series of images that are breathtaking. Verse 5 of chapter 5. He is the one who is the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David. John hears of a lion, but when he looks and turns, he sees a lamb, looking as if it has been slain. The Lion of the tribe of Judah goes back to Genesis 49, verses 9 and 10, where the prophecy was made that from the tribe of Judah, the ruling, conquering Messiah would come. And John's expecting to see a warrior prince, and he turns, and he sees a lamb that bears the mark of having been slaughtered. Now, I'll come back to this image in a later sermon because I can't unpack it all here. But this lamb is not weak. This lamb is standing and it has seven horns on its head, and horns in Revelation symbolize power. And it's anointed with the sevenfold spirit, which is probably a reference to the Holy Spirit. So it's not a lamb that is weak, but it is a lamb that wears the scars. Jesus will never lose his scars because they glorify him. And you will always need to know that he won by dying. That he defeated death and sin, not by force, but by death. Not by violence, but by martyrdom. For Jesus, there was no crown except by a way of a cross. And so we live as people who worship a lion who was also a lamb, who came not to bring a sword, but his own life. And the whole scene just glorifies Jesus. It highlights that only the Lamb can unlock the scroll. Only the Lamb can initiate God's purposes for the world. And then it happens. Because of what the Lamb has done, the vision kind of skips on forward to the future and the present and shows you what happens because the Lamb has opened the scroll. The first thing that comes in verse 9 is that they sing a new song. No longer are old songs appropriate once the Lamb's on the scene. A new song has to be sung. A new word has to be given. Because men and women of every colour, of every tongue, can come through the Lamb and know rescue in the hands of God. Whether it be the Japanese kid contemplating suicide, or the rich kid at the stock exchange contemplating another act of mammon worship, everyone can come home. And then what it says is that we are restored to the glory of Adam. See where it says in verse 10 that God has made his people to be kingdom and priests to serve him, which is exactly what Adam and Eve were made in the beginning. Because being made in the image of God and set in the Garden of Eden is to be made a king and a priest. And God restores to them the glory of Adam and then some through the one who is the second Adam. And note carefully what their purpose will be: to reign upon the earth. Not to go to heaven, but to await the time when God's kingdom will come on earth and they will reign with him on earth. But that's not enough for God, because verses 11, 12 and 13 and 14 keep going. And you see the widening circles of impact of the death of Jesus Christ and his resurrection and what it has brought. And the widening circles of praise. First you have angels, but then you ultimately have all creatures of our God and King sing. Because what Jesus did on the cross will not just rescue human beings, it will drag creation into it as well. God's kingly rule is coming to the earth. And all creatures of our God and King will sing. And we will sing with them. For those of you who are tempted to believe that this world is all there is, you need to know that there's another kind of normal, and it's this. The world is not the way it was, nor is it the way it will be. This world is a temporary aberration at best. This is not where you want to set up your home. To the person who's suffering despair, to the one who's suffering injustice, to the one who is engaged in idolatry, we want to say, this is not the way it's supposed to be. There's a different world that's coming. All of which leads me to give these reflections on true worship. Firstly, worship is, without a shadow of a doubt, a rebel song. This side of the second coming, anybody who worships God is ultimately rebelling against the present state of things. To worship God, to have him at the center, means to be a rebel against the surrounding society. Because this world doesn't have God at its center. In that sense, worship is an act of civil disobedience. I refuse to believe that this is all there is. I refuse to believe that Bill Gates or Bin Laden or George Bush runs the world. God runs it. To be a worshipper is to be a rebel against the present order. And in some society, that kind of rebellion is going to get you killed. So what? Second, worship is the life you're meant to live. You were meant to live for so much more. The creation was meant to be so much more. It was meant to ceaselessly praise our Maker. And so that is what we should do. It is the life we're meant to live. It is not simply that worship happens here on a Sunday night, because worship, the songs that we sing, are merely the fruit of the life that we're living. So the true worshipper is the one who stands in their workplace and says, I refuse to be engaged in that corrupt behaviour. It's the one who says amongst their group of friends, I refuse to engage in that sexual immorality. It's the one who says to world leaders, I refuse to believe that it's economically rational to watch people die. That's what it means to live a life of worship. And then we sing. And finally, worship is the song of a new creation. You see, when people walk into this place, I don't want them to encounter a new philosophy, because the philosophy won't save them. I don't want them to encounter a new kind of style, a new kind of fashion, a new kind of way of doing music, a new kind of way of speaking. I want them to encounter a different universe, because God is at the center of it. When they walk in that door, they're not merely experiencing a geographical change, they're walking from one world into another. That's what his song is about. That it's about a new creation, where here we practice a new kind of humanity, a humanity that's as old as Genesis and as eternal as Revelation's message. That's what we do here. And that's why I believe Stanley Grenz gets it right when he says, our corporate identity lies in the future. What the church is determined by what the church is destined to become. And the church is destined to be nothing less than a new humanity, the glorious company of God's redeemed people who inhabit the renewed creation and enjoy the presence of the triune God. In the meantime, the Spirit calls us out of the world that we might be a company who pioneer in the present what the future will be like. Our task is to live according to the principles that characterize God's future goal for creation. Our purpose is to be a foretaste of the glorious eternity that God will one day give us in its fullness. In short, the church is a sign of the kingdom. We are to point the way toward the future.